This is The Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, a medical researcher finds frightening correlations between people who apply pesticides and increased birth defects in Minnesota. In our continuing series on climate change, we hear from people who say it's a mistake to make big policy changes to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Ranger Rick, the raccoon who has taught kids about nature, is 30 years old. The masked bandit has to deal with computers as he reaches middle age. And in the Earth calendar, we watch the leaves turn in Kentucky, where there are more varieties of trees in that one state than in all of Europe. Dr. Vincent Gehry is a professor and director of environmental medicine and pathology at the University of Minnesota. He's been doing research on the correlation between certain agricultural chemicals and birth defects. What he did was to look at the registry of births of those babies who had a parent that was a pesticide applicator. That means either a person who applies pesticides for a living or a farmer who puts chemicals on land or crops by himself.
Our first studies were a computer-based record linkage study between pesticide suppliers and their children and the state birth registry. And in that particular instance, what you're able to recover are birth defects found at birth. And in general, what we find is that if we divide our state of Minnesota up into several different areas, two involving agriculture, different types of agricultural practice, and the other in our more forested areas, we find that in the agricultural areas, the rate of birth defects is higher than in our more urban or forested areas. In addition to that, when we look at certain kinds of crops, we find that the highest rate of birth defects occurred in the region where we do sugar beets, potatoes, and wheat. And then if we have a look at the fellows who are pesticide appliers, we find in general the rate of birth defects is higher among them, and then that is higher than the people living in the communities where they come from.
Specifically, Dr. Gehry reports that birth defects among the children of pesticide applicators are about 1.5 times greater than in babies born to people in the surrounding community. He found 20 to 30 defects out of about 35,000 applicators. In addition, he found that birth defects among the general populace in the agricultural northern and western portions of Minnesota were in turn about 1.5 times higher than folks who lived in forested and urban areas where pesticides are not applied. Looking further, Gehry found birth defects among children of pesticide applicators varied both according to the time of conception and sex.
We focused then on northwestern Minnesota, and when we did that, we looked at things like when the child was conceived, and we found that there's a seasonal variation in that children that are conceived in the spring, you're more likely to find birth defects. That's the first thing. In that area, we also saw that, and in general among the appliers, there's generally more males that have birth defects anyhow, but in the appliers, it was even more so.
Gehry then looked for correlation between the increased birth defects and particular types of pesticides that are being used.
We used another database to look at what was applied where, you know, in terms of pesticide. In the region where we saw the highest birth defects, which also had the highest usage of chlorpheniroxy herbicides, and fungicides in our state.
Dr. Gehry emphasizes that what he has found is correlation and not cause. Determining cause is the next phase of his research, which will require getting out into the communities and involving families in specialized medical studies. Many of these are folk who suffered considerable hardship last spring through the flooding of the Red River Valley, a sight which many of us saw documented on national television news. A year and a half ago, researchers Colburn, Dumanowski, and Myers published a book called Our Stolen Future. It recounted increasing evidence of the impact of endocrine disruptors. Those are chemicals that have an effect on the reproductive system of animals and humans. While some attacked the book as hyperbole, correlations between birth defects and exposure to pesticides, such as those found by Dr. Gary, indicate that we need to know a lot more about agricultural chemicals before we ignore those who are sounding an alarm. The issue of global warming is receiving more media attention than probably any other topic. Many scientists are warning of a 3 to 4 degree increase in surface temperature over the next century, which could cause severe climate change. Meanwhile, there are others who say more data needs to be collected and that taking enormous steps to reduce carbon emissions without knowing all of the facts could hurt the U.S. economy. In our continuing series of reports on global warming, The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott reports on those who take a more conservative approach toward the issue.
Many in the scientific community say the 1 degree increase in overall global temperature is a direct result of industry, the burning of fossil fuels, and automobile emissions. This is one of the major beliefs of scientists who also say that if measures aren't taken to reduce emissions, global climate could rise as much as 4 degrees by the year 2100, causing droughts, floods, and other catastrophic weather conditions. But not everyone in the scientific community agrees with these theories. Henry Linden is professor of energy and power engineering and management at the Illinois Institute of Technology in Chicago and director of the Energy and Power Center at the private university. He believes the 1 degree rise in temperature over the past 100 years is attributed to a recovery from what he calls the Little Ice Age.
There was a period from 1400 to 1900 A.D., when global surface temperatures were substantially lower than normal. And so two-thirds of this 1 degree Fahrenheit temperature increase since the mid-late 1800s occurred prior to 1940, when there was hardly any emission of greenhouse gases yet. There were much emissions were 20% of what they are today or less.
While some say the century's warmest temperatures are happening now and are a result of global warming, Professor Linden says statistics show the warmest period actually occurred in the 1930s. Professor Linden also disagrees with those predicting a 3 to 4 degree temperature increase. By his calculations, Linden says surface temperatures will rise less than 3 degrees and says many scientists are overestimating the negative effects.
The problem with these higher numbers that you see floating around is that they assume a lot of positive feedback effects as a result of some warming, such as cloud formation, increased water content in the atmosphere. One molecule of water in the stratosphere is 500 times more effective as a greenhouse gas as a molecule near the surface.
Professor Linden says 97% of the greenhouse effect that maintains the global surface temperature at livable levels is due to water vapor. He says increased water vapor could increase cloud formations. Linden theorizes these additional clouds could help reflect many of the sun's rays, keeping temperatures cooler. He also takes issue with the predictions of severe weather. Linden says there is no statistical evidence showing that such catastrophic changes will occur. Meanwhile, there are some that believe the U.S. will benefit from overall temperature increases. Among them is Thomas Moore, an economist and senior fellow with the Hoover Institution, a conservative think tank at Stanford University in California. Moore maintains the country's transportation systems will improve as a result of global warming.
The less snow and ice on the roads in the winter would facilitate both automobile traffic and truck traffic. reducing accidents and improving delivery of goods and services and making it life easier for people to get to work and get around. Less shoveling of snow is a good thing for most people. And the heating bills would go down in the winter more than any increase in the summer temperatures would push up air conditioning bills.
In addition, Moore believes the quality of life in the U.S. will improve. He says people will likely live longer since, according to Moore, residents of warmer climates live longer than those in colder areas. Moore says he is concerned that the U.S. will take steps to reduce carbon dioxide emissions while developing countries conduct business as usual. He is afraid the American economy might suffer as a result. Gail McDonald, president of the Global Climate Coalition, shares Moore's concern. GCC is an industry-oriented organization representing some 230,000 businesses. While some say you can have both a reduction in carbon emissions and economic prosperity, McDonald says recent studies, such as those conducted by Wharton Economics, show adverse economic impacts if too much is done too soon.
We see, you know, as I say, higher cost of living for individuals, for some industries, devastation and imperatives to move to developing nations where there would be no increased prices. And as I say, significant impacts that would work all the way through the economy, much as you saw in the 1970s when oil and gas prices were so high.
Industry groups and their supporting companies are conducting huge ad campaigns warning Americans of the potential economic effects they believe will occur. McDonald does not believe mandates from the federal government are the way to reduce carbon emissions. She believes voluntary initiatives and market-based efforts are the best way to reduce emission problems, something she says many businesses have already started.
They have been able to cut both emissions and their use of energy substantially in the last 20 years. Recently, one of our larger organizations, the Iron and Steel Institute, pledged to take an extra 10% off its processes in the next 10 years. So these are businesses who believe that there will be significant economic impacts to a treaty that requires legally binding targets and timetables.
McDonald says Americans should become involved in the debate because, as she and others at GCC say, the global warming issue has environmental and trade consequences that could impact us all and our children. I'm Stephen Westcott for The Environment Show.
Stay with us. Ranger Rick is turning 30, and the trees are red in Kentucky. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, Bob and Marilyn Schumann, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the Collector Car Hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. I'm Peter Burley, and the Environment Show wants to hear from you. Give us your views by telephone at 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Or by email, green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. It's difficult to believe, but Ranger Rick and the magazine that bears his name are celebrating their 30th birthday.
12-year-old Michael Reutbert is a typical Ranger Rick reader. He loves the Dear Ranger Rick page, he enjoys the pictures, And he says reading the magazine not only informs him about the environment, but it keeps him in touch with what other kids are doing.
Well, I've learned that a lot of kids are participating in cleaning up the environment or helping animals, and I've learned that sometimes you shouldn't really mess with nature, just leave it the way it is. So I think you should do that.
Like Michael, most ranger Rick readers are between the ages of 7 and 12, learning lessons about the environment, which editor Jerry Bishop hopes will leave an impression on them. According to Bishop, the decision to bring the concerns of the natural world to kids was made in the mid-1960s. Its publisher, the National Wildlife Federation, already boasted a successful magazine for adults and thought, why not do the same for children?
Our mission has always been the same from the very beginning. It's been to delight children with spectacular color photographs. That's what the National Wildlife was famous for. We use a lot of charming, funny illustrations, exciting reading, really good stories. And they're all aimed at inspiring a greater understanding of the natural world, a deep love of nature and wildlife, and we hope a lifelong commitment to conservation. And that's still pretty much our credo today. We've changed in several ways, though. We're still focused on the traditional aspects of nature and wildlife, but I think we've expanded our editorial range to reach out to a broader readership, mainly in competition with television and other distractions kids have.
Bishop admits keeping up with the lure of television and the flashy graphics of computers has been Ranger Rick's biggest challenge. He says they live in fear that kids will put the magazine down and walk away to do something else.
Kids' lives are so scripted these days, so heavily scheduled. When I grew up, my God, you know, we had a hard time filling our day. We'd sit around saying things like, what do you want to do today? I don't know. I asked you first, you know. And then when we did decide to do something, we'd just walk along a stream and turn over rocks and catch salamanders, things like that, and that was what we called fun. Today, I think it's soccer practice, it's karate lessons, it's music class, it's I guess teachers have a lot. I mean, parents have a lot of reasons for doing this to their kids, but I feel like they've been taking away some of the just leisure time that kids should have to be able to curl up with a good book or a good magazine and enjoy themselves. And I think that busy schedule is what makes it so challenging for us to produce a magazine that has holding power.
So how does Ranger Rick manage to maintain a readership of over 700,000 kids? Bishop says after 30 years, they found that if they choose interesting subjects and write about them in ways that are engaging and information-filled, the child's curiosity will do the rest. But one key strategy, he says, in keeping kids interested has been to make the magazine as interactive as possible by encouraging kids to write about what inspires them. In recent years, though, several outlets of environmental education have come under attack. Some are worried kids are being urged to take on more than they can handle, or that children are being scared into becoming activists. Bishop says so far Ranger Rick has steered clear of any attacks, but as a devoted environmentalist, he believes he has an obligation to today's youth to encourage environmental advocacy.
What really burns me up about the whole thing is that there may be, on some rare occasions, some teachers who push an agenda, in some circumstances, if you consider studying the rainforest and thinking about the consequences of over-harvesting or that kind of thing as an agenda. But I think what's really insidious about this attack is that industry, corporations have for years just inundated our classrooms with free materials that really doesn't take too much imagination to see what they're trying to promote. They're trying to promote their own products. They're trying to promote consumption of any kinds of goods. And it's, this is going to be going on for years, and yet the minute the environmental community tries to get their message across through some of the materials that they're producing, everyone raises a big stink about it. So I think it's kind of a phony agenda.
Ultimately, Bishop says the goal is to help kids see the world as something that should be cherished. He hopes Ranger Rick is the vehicle that inspires them to incorporate nature into their lives. And judging from their loyal subscribers, Ranger Rick will be around for yet another generation of raccoon lovers. For The Environment Show, I'm Stephanie Goichman.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. Trees along the Kentucky River are now ablaze. They're red and yellow and orange. The river cuts through limestone cliffs south of the city of Lexington and leads to the Jim Beam Nature Preserve, which is maintained by the Nature Conservancy. Jim Aldrich is the Kentucky director of the Conservancy, and he says one reason there's so much color and so much variety is there are more tree species in the Commonwealth of Kentucky than in all of Europe.
We're in the heart of what's called the what scientists refer to as the mixed mesophytic forest, which basically means that there are lots and lots of different tree species in the state of Kentucky, and particularly in central Kentucky, and on the limestone soils, we have a large number of tree species. And the middle to end of October is our peak season in terms of fall color. It's really outstanding. We have, of course, the first species to start changing color, and they're already well on their way, are the sumacs, and those are more small tree or shrub species than actual big trees. But the Carolina buckthorn, another small tree species, and tupelo, those three species all turn brilliant reds or crimsons.
The turning of the leaves in the forest has its own rhythm. Next to change are the maples.
The red maples, the sugar maples, and the less colorful is the softer silver maple. But we have those three species as well, and those are just beginning to change. And mixed in with those, of course, is the American beech and a number of oak species that are later to turn than the maples and beech. But by the end of October, they're turning colors as well. And the number of oak species that we have at the Jim Beam Preserve and in central Kentucky along the Kentucky River is easily over 10. They include species like the bur oak, which is a huge tree that occurs along bottomlands and in central Kentucky on uplands as well. It's a favorite species of wildlife because it produces a large acorn or nut, and it's a very sweet nut.
Aldrich says you can find a number of oak varieties in the preserve, such as white, black, scarlet, and pin. Everything is in full color. Flowers like asters and shrubs like cherry viburnum add to the display. At this season, we talk of leaves turning color, but in fact, the color is always there. Yellows and oranges and reds in the leaf are masked by chlorophyll during the growing season. Chlorophyll is green and is dominant when present.
As the leaves are preparing to lose their leaves, then what they're trying to do is capture the energy that's still left in those leaves before they fall to the ground. And the process that they do that is first the chlorophyll disappears in the leaf, and there's energy in the chlorophyll or the green leaf. Of course, that's used in the photosynthesis process, which gives energy to trees. Trees take up carbon dioxide and release oxygen, so that's why they're great, and all plants do that, of course. So when the chlorophyll leaves the leaf, it's masking the other pigments that are still there, and so you start seeing those. Those are the carotenes, which are the yellow and orange colors, and there's erythrocytes as well, which are the red pigments.
So if you're looking somewhat green someday, perhaps because of something you ate or some other malady, take heart. Like the blazing leaves along the Kentucky River, you are probably not green all the way through. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show. Our telephone number is 1-888-4-8-8. 49 Green, and I'm Peter Burley. This is the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, E! Magazine says Wyoming is the worst state in the country when it comes to recycling, and New Jersey is the best. We talk to officials in charge of the effort to find out why. We talk green about pollution coming out of a tailpipe of your vehicle. Can it be reduced? Does Detroit have its head in the sand? Or are auto manufacturers producing what people want for the best price? Author Colin Fletcher presents us a portrait of a stretch of the Colorado River, which pulls him from bank to bank as he makes his way to the sea. These stories and more coming up. Recycling has become a daily part of American life in many parts of the country, but in some places, recycling is rarely practiced. An article in E, the environmental magazine, lists the states with the best and the worst recycling habits, showing a large gap between those who recycle and those who don't. The Environment Show's Rachel Phillips reports.
The figures in E! Magazine show that Wyoming has the lowest percentage of recycled materials in the United States, followed by Alaska and Mississippi. Quite an ironic distinction considering Wyoming's abundant natural resources. Diana Gentry Hogel, recycling coordinator for the Department of Environmental Quality, Solid and Hazardous Waste Division, says 3% is the figure she's always heard. The article shows a percentage of about 2.3%. Gentry Hogel believes the recycling percentage rate to be higher than 3% because there is no accurate method of measurement. She says comparing Wyoming to some other states is like comparing apples to oranges.
Some of these states, the figures they give will include scrap metal recycling for automobile dealers. They'll also include battery recycling, waste oil. They may or may not include compostable materials such as yard waste, tree trimmings, that type of thing. So, comparing Wyoming to these other states, I think it's interesting because while I think it's certainly lower than some place like Washington, Oregon, or Minnesota, I don't know what the actual figure is, and that 3% figure has been floating around for almost a decade.
Gentry Hogel says recycling is a service, one that needs resources such as people and financial support. She says because Wyoming is the least populated state in the country, it cannot offer the services that other states can. Recycling and composting efforts in many Wyoming communities are a result of volunteers. She believes such efforts have increased in recent years, but says collection programs are mainly the responsibility of local governments. She says the state has set goals for the localities.
They're all voluntary. Of course, this is Wyoming. The word mandatory is not a good word. So they are voluntary goals that we are trying to encourage in local governments. I believe it's 25% recycling rate by the year 2005, and it goes up to 35% by 2005 if the organic fraction, the composting, is included. I do see recycling has definitely increased in Wyoming. That's why that 3% figure I think is erroneous that's been floating around for so long, because since I've been on this job, I've seen increases in the amount of material as well as composting, the composting programs that never existed before that exist now that clearly are saving materials from, you know, not going into the landfill.
While the Environmental Protection Agency's Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, Subtitle D, regulates landfilling, there are no mandates for recycling. In the late 1980s, the EPA announced a voluntary goal of 25%. But surprisingly, Gentry Hogel believes the federal government should place recycling mandates on states, an opinion that would undoubtedly fall into the category of rubbish for many Wyoming residents. Guy Watson also disagrees. He's chief of the Bureau of Recycling and Planning for New Jersey's Department of Environmental Protection. His state has the highest recycling rates in the country, with 60%. New Jersey is followed by Wisconsin and Minnesota. Watson believes states can design their own plans.
What the federal government probably could do is look very carefully at what kind of financial or tax incentives they could provide to private businesses to invest in recycling infrastructure. And if that means that there is, for example, maybe not a level playing field right now between the virgin resource extraction industry, mining and logging in that, and the recycled or the recycling industry, then those, then if there is not a level playing field, it should be made a level playing field.
But Watson does agree with Diana Gentry Hogel on one point, and that is because New Jersey is the most densely populated state of the nation, picking up reusable materials is far easier than in Wyoming. On the other hand, composting organic materials in the neighborhoods of the Garden State is not very practical. Overall, he believes New Jersey's recycling efforts have been successful, something Watson expects will continue.
The commissioner has indicated that he would like to see the state achieve a 65% recycling rate by the year 2000, and we believe we can achieve that if we are able to increase our recycling in those areas I mentioned, like composting and mixed paper, and if we can continue the level of recycling that we have right now with construction and demolition materials and the curbside recycling, we should be able to achieve that 65% goal.
Watson adds New Jersey is fortunate to have 60-plus paper processors and 16 paper mills taking paper from New York and New Jersey. Saturday, November 15th, marks the first annual America Recycles Day. More than 40 states in the country have officially recognized the event to increase awareness about the importance of recycling. How popular this event will be in Wyoming remains to be seen. For the Environment Show, I'm Rachel Phillips.
We're Talking Green, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Today, we're talking about what comes out of the tailpipe of your automobile. Recently, the chiefs of the big three U.S. automakers told President Clinton that mandatory emissions reductions would spell disaster for their industry. My guests today are Dan Becker. He's the director of the Global Warming and Energy Program with the Sierra Club, and he was appointed by President Clinton to a commission on auto exhaust emissions. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Also with us is Dr. Richard Klimisch. He's Vice President of Engineering Affairs with the American Automobile Manufacturers Association, and he's an expert on alternative fuels and was one of the pioneers of the catalytic converter. He joins us from Detroit, Michigan. And so, Dick Klimisch, let's start with you. A lot of people say the American auto industry lives with its head in the sand. They say that technological improvement is not possible, and yet the next thing you know, the Japanese are selling cars in the United States, which seem to do what the manufacturers have been resisting. And just this week, I note that Toyota has announced that it will be selling a hybrid car in Japan for about $17,000 that will get 56 miles per gallon. Why doesn't Detroit get behind efforts to dramatically reduce auto exhaust?
Well, we are. In fact, we have a program that's part of the Clean Air Act that's technology forcing that runs clear out past 2004. And in fact, we have the big three have introduced a whole series of cars. Now, The electric vehicle activities of General Motors are second to none. The Toyota announcement on hybrids is very impressive. We all have hybrid vehicles. The question is, a couple questions, the cost issue, whether the consumers will buy the vehicles, but we believe we're behind this. I think that the U.S. auto industry dominates industrial research and development. We have very large programs, in fact.
Okay. Well, Dan Becker from Sierra, do you agree that the U.S. auto industry dominates these programs and is on top of the power curve?
I think it would be shocking to people in other countries if they looked at the big three U.S. auto producers and saw how they run from technology. On the shelves in Detroit are scads of different technologies that would make our cars cleaner and more efficient. And if we don't produce those vehicles and create jobs in this country making vehicles that go further on a gallon of gas, surely we will end up importing them from Japan and Europe. And it really is our responsibility. More carbon dioxide pollution, the major pollutant that causes global warming, comes spewing out of the tailpipes of America's cars and light trucks than out of all sources of global warming pollution in the entire country of India. So we have a responsibility to make reductions, and we have the technology that the industry refuses to put on its vehicles. In 1975, Congress passed a law called the Corporate Average Fuel Economy Law, the mile per gallon law. And at that time, Ford Motor Company testified that the law would never work, that, quote, it would require a Ford product line consisting of all sub-Pinto-sized vehicles or some mix of vehicles ranging from a sub-subcompact to perhaps a Maverick, close quote. They've always said it can't be done, and we need to require that they do it for our children's future.
Okay, well, let's look at that issue, because I think the magic word there was require. And Dick, that I assume is a word which puts the manufacturers in orbit. They don't want to be required to do this. Why not?
Well, the fundamental problem is that we have a free market, and we can make cars that have better fuel economy, but the question is, will the customers buy it? And that gets down to the price of gasoline. You know, the price of gasoline is $5 a gallon. I think it's like $6 in Italy, and you can put, for example, technology like very lightweight materials that are very expensive, but at a buck a gallon, it doesn't pay for the customers. And if you'll notice, the importers in the U.S. are producing the similar kind of cars. The Japanese small cars, like the Accord, started as a small car, and now they're mid-sized.
Well, let's just look at that issue for a minute. If, and people may not agree with this, but if one of the national objectives should be to reduce air pollution, what is the best way to get there, at least from the perspective of the auto manufacturers, in the most rapid and cost-effective way?
Well, the program we've got is working very well. As I said, the 90 amendments to the Clean Air Act haven't really run their course. We're making incredible progress.
But when those amendments were passed, isn't Dan Becker right that the auto industry just resisted those from beginning to end?
Following
Becker's argument, maybe it ought to be done again
We've tried to change that. The question, as you mentioned, is cost effectiveness, how fast you can do it, and whether you can make a vehicle that anyone will buy. The electric vehicle mandate in California is an example. They had to give up on that because, you know, the vehicles aren't selling. We're selling.
Well, wait a minute, Dick. They gave up on that because of pressure from the auto and oil industry on the governor, and he caved.
No, it was technology.
You hadn't introduced the cars yet. Look, right now we have the technology to make cars go further on a gallon of gas and meet the other requirements that people want for a car. It doesn't have to change the size or the performance of the car in order to make it go further on a gallon of gas. People will save money at the gas pump. We can thumb our nose at Saddam Hussein and his oil, but the auto industry won't get off its tailpipe and begin to make these changes.
Dan,
and
we got 50-mile-per-gallon cars out there. They're not selling. They're in the marketplace already.
Well, Dick, let me ask you something. You say you've got 50-mile cars, and they're not selling because they don't have the performance, perhaps, than others.
What about producing a vehicle that does have the performance? Is that technologically impossible?
Sure, it is. No, it's possible, but then you get into the trade-off is cost, because, and so you have to balance these things. It's a competitive market. If we abandon the market, somebody else is going to take it over. I mean, as I say, it's a free market. So,
well, Dick, that's the first thing you said I agree with you on. Honda has introduced a vehicle that is a Honda Civic that for $700 more than another Honda Civic, you get a 55% improvement in fuel economy. And what we need to do is we need to educate the American people that those choices may exist, but the big three should be producing those vehicles. We shouldn't have to import them all from Japan.
We are producing those vehicles. There's a number of big three vehicles that are over 50 miles per gallon, but the sales of that segment of the market is pretty small, and I believe it's primarily because of the price of fuel in this country.
Well, you talked about the EV1 and how people aren't buying it.
General Motors
is rejecting three-quarters of the people who apply to buy that vehicle. So General Motors isn't doing what it should be doing if it really wanted to make that vehicle a success. And what the American people need to do is we need to have rules that require the auto industry to move forward. It's since 1989, when the CAFE standards stopped.
Why don't we have rules on what kind of cars people can buy? I mean, it is free. It's still a free country, Dan. Let me ask you both something.
Hold on just a second. If one were to put in generic kind of rules that were specific about emissions and perhaps miles per gallon, is it your position, Dick, that the industry simply could not produce a marketable product in accordance with those rules?
No, we already have the system. We've got both the fuel economy and emission laws by EPA and by NHTSA are based on technological feasibility. And that's, you know, we have lots of argument about what's technological feasible, but ultimately when that's decided, we deliver, and we're meeting the laws, and where technological feasibility is today.
You guys have lobbied Congress to freeze the mile per gallon standard so that you don't have to put the technology that exists on those vehicles to let them go further on a gallon of gas. Since 1989, when the CAFE standards ran their course, you guys have been going backward on fuel economy, not forward. And this year, the average fuel economy, the average miles per gallon of the fleet of domestic vehicles is at the 1980 level. Inefficient as we were back in 1980.
That's nuts. Well, what's happened, the cars, in fact, the CAFE law primarily was for cars, and those went up to 27.5 miles per gallon. The customer said, I need bigger, I need to tow, once a year I want to tow my boat up north, so I'm going to buy a truck, and people are buying trucks. What Dan's referring to is combining the cars.
Sure.
So people are buying more and more trucks,
but
station wagon is gone.
Isn't the next question whether if there were rules that applied to the trucks and the Suburbans and the utility vehicles, whether those wouldn't improve performance because the law would apply to them too?
Well, sure, you could make laws that improve the fuel economy. One of the reasons people buy trucks is perceptions about safety, and utility and towing capacity, all those things. As I say, it's still a free market, and I really think Congress wouldn't pass a law because these kinds of vehicles are important to people. We talk often about the problems of vehicles, pollution and accidents, but there are a lot of benefits people get out of vehicles, and I think you keep forgetting about those: the privacy, the independence, the freedom of mobility. I mean, it's the envy of the world.
But the problem is that these emissions that spew out of these vehicles are jeopardizing the future for our children. They're making the climate warm, they're polluting and filling our cities with smog, and in order for our kids to live in a safer and healthier environment, we need to begin to clamp down on these emissions. And if Detroit won't do it by itself, then obviously the government needs to have a role here. Otherwise, our kids are going to grow up in a greenhouse, and I don't think you want that either, Dick.
Let me ask the technical question here. I think a lot of us have such faith in American technology or technology in general that we assume we can do anything. Are you saying, Dick, that if one had strict requirements with respect to fuel economy and so on, one could not produce with today's technology the sport utility vehicles and the pickups that would meet the consumer demand because from an engineering point of view, it just can't be done?
Well, if you put in cost and performance, any individual company that tried that, let's say, to reduce performance or increase cost, is going to lose in the marketplace.
And I gather that's a position, Dan, that you don't necessarily agree with.
No, this is the industry that said we can't make cars with seat belts, we can't make cars with airbags, we can't make cars with catalytic converters for smog, and now they say we can't make cars or light trucks that get over 27.5 miles per gallon. We're America. We've got technology. The auto industry won't use it, but we can solve these problems if the auto industry will help and stop looking at their short-term, short-sighted bottom line for this year and think about the future. At some point, it is likely that oil prices are going to rise, Dick, and at that point, you guys are going to get caught behind the eight ball when the Japanese come in and say, we're ready, we'll sell you efficient cars and trucks, and the American big three say, gee, give us 5 years.
Well, you know, Dan, I got to say something about the air pollution. We think we've made incredible progress on air pollution, and that will continue. In terms of global warming, that's a big threat to this country, and your story about greenhouse, I don't believe, is shared by science. That's a very controversial issue in spite of some claims to the controversy.
Well, and the tobacco industry still says that smoking doesn't cause cancer.
Well, that's fine, but this is bigger. I mean, the Senate passed a resolution 95-0. I mean, that's a pretty big statement in terms of their view of the approach we're taking to global warming.
Let me ask both of you in our short time remaining, what needs to be done to improve technology the most rapidly? Dick, just 20 seconds.
Well, the answer to these problems is clearly technology, but part of it may be public policy as well. But we need some technological breakthroughs. What I'm really worried about is the global warming problem. And that gets to countries like China and India. If they're not going to use fossil fuels, we've got to find some way to help them. And it's an incredible technological challenge. But what we can't do is impoverish America in the bargain, as an example.
Okay. Dan Becker, your view on that?
Dick is right that technology is the answer. Technology already exists to make cars go further on a gallon of gas, and we have both the moral obligation to our kids and the responsibility and opportunity to sell these technologies to China.
Okay, I'm afraid our time is up, and I want to thank you all for joining us. My guests have been Dan Becker from the Sierra Club and Dick Klimisch from the American Automobile Manufacturers Association. We've been talking green about auto emissions, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Stay with us. We're going to float down the Colorado River next. I'm Peter Burley, and the Environment Show wants to hear from you. How much exhaust does your car spit out? Our email address is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. You can also hear us over the web or contact us through our website, www.enn.com/envshow. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. Author Colin Fletcher presents a portrait of his special place, which is a stretch of the Colorado River, where the current has a rhythm of its own and his craft is tugged from shore to shore. He paddled alone the length of the river and wrote a book entitled River, One Man's Journey Down the Colorado River, Source to Sea.
Early in my journey, I spent one long afternoon rafting down a swift but unchallenging reach of the river. Hour after hour, I seemed to be swinging in close to one bank, then swinging back out and gliding toward the other, and a mirror reprise. A modified reprise. For although the day had by now developed a specific and meticulous rhythm, details were always changing. Only patterns persisted. The river, as usual, was playing theme and variations. Now, such repetitive music can in time lull you into a dreamlike, almost hallucinatory state of timelessness. Theme and variations. The current swings in toward a left bank meadow, and I push gently on the right oar and pull gently on the left, and the raft pivots broadside, so that we move on down, the raft and I, with the bulging blue bow riding close herd on the meadow's fringing grasses, which are all I can now see except for the background strip of pale blue sky and sailing white galleon clouds. And then I adjust our position with soft forward pressure on both oars, and the bow is brushing the longest of the drooping grass stems, and I'm admiring a daisy that pushes up pink and delicate in between green tussocks. And then I see a dead bush hanging out over the water a dozen yards downstream, and I pull softly on both oars, and the bow eases away from the bank, and we pass the dead bush. And its outermost fringe is brushing the top of the bow, and I can hear the faint ping as brittle twigs flick the taut tube. And then the current is swinging away from the bank, and so are we. And out there the river and my world are wider and brighter, and we're moving down toward a tongue that lips over a bar in a channel so narrow that once I've positioned us accurately above it, I pivot us with a flick of the oars and float through, bow first, with a narrow strip of smooth water on each side gleaming in the sunlight, and broken water glittering beyond it, and also out beyond the blue bow. And then the broken water is tapping messages on the taut drum of the raft floor, and I'm swinging us around to face the right bank, where the current is already heading. And this time the bank is green and dark with overhanging trees and bushes, and I ease us to within a foot of their outer branches, and the light is soft and muted. But the swirling water keeps drum-talking to us, and back in the trees and bushes the birds are talking, too, deep inside the huge silence that envelops us all. And then we are swinging out and away once more, and this time the river is ready to relax into a long pool, and the tongue that leads into it is deep and smooth, and we move through it broadside. And I can look back and see the whole big, beautiful cottonwood grove that we have unknowingly skirted. And then the tongue begins to swirl and break, and I let it swing the raft around until we're facing the left bank, which this time is a brown bluff that curves so evenly, with the current rippling serenely by, that I can hold the raft's smooth blue bow within inches of the rough brown rock, and let my eye run along the pockmarked ledge and follow the escape route of a small and terrified lizard that scurries into deep shadow below the ledge and vanishes. And then we're once more swinging out and away, and this time the tongue is two tongues, with white water dividing them. And I choose the nearer one, and we glide smoothly through it, and as we begin to swing toward the new right bank, I detect a whisper of a breeze bearing news from the south, from the sea, and find myself out there in the middle of the wide river, the wide world, relishing and rolling around my palate and striving to grasp and fix in memory the cadence of the river's rhythm with its themes and variations that are echoes of wider themes and variations.
Colin Fletcher is the author of River, One Man's Journey Down the Colorado River, Source to Sea, published by Alfred A. Knopf. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. You can't make it down the Colorado without a cassette copy of the tape. It's 1-888-49-GREEN, show number 407. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is the executive producer. Producers are Rachel Phillips and Stephen Westcott. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Walton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, Bob and Marilyn Schumann, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby. 1-800-7000. CARHERE. Be good to the earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.